Hi, everybody, and welcome to Tap into Psychedelics. I'm your host, Adam Tapp, and with me is my friend and producer, Handsome Jason. And today our guest is Neil Markley, who is the CEO and co-founder of Beckley Retreats. How are you doing, Neil?
Hey, doing great. Thanks for having me, Adam.
No, man, it's a pleasure. You know, we've talked a couple times. We met at the Microdose conference, and I've been looking forward to this interview. So why don't you just tell us a little bit about yourself? Because I'm always like really intrigued how people get to this place, you know what I mean, in such an interesting environment.
Yeah, I guess it starts for me. I was a bit of a math nerd and was studying math at University of Maryland. And then September 11th happened, and that kind of changed everything. I thought maybe I would go to the intelligence agencies and do cryptology. They were recruiting a lot of math majors from Maryland then. And I mean, long story short, I ended up in the service. I was a lieutenant. I went to Iraq with an infantry platoon. And then, you know, the stars aligned. It takes a lot of luck and timing, but I got picked up and went to the Ranger Regiment, which is a small special operations unit that was doing direct action missions in Afghanistan at that time. And, you know, part of me loved it. You know, I was more on the support side of things, you know, so I wasn't even in the most intense things that a lot of the Rangers were doing, but it was really exciting, but like incredibly traumatic, you know. You know, it was Pat Tillman's old battalion. He was the Arizona Cardinal that gave up his professional football contract to come and serve. Leroy Petrie got the Medal of Honor when I was there. Obama was talking about the missions that the guys were doing on the news quite frequently. So it was larger than life to be there. And I was around these guys that I really looked up to. But it was tough, man. I mean, we lost a lot of guys during those years. And then, you know, not only was it crazy overseas, but you know, the mental health was in crisis. When I was on my first Ranger deployment, a lot of the guys were on like their 10th or 11th. They had been deploying pretty much nonstop since September 11th. And so the trauma in the organization was pretty unbelievable. At one point in time, we had 3 suicides in 90 days. So, I mean, it was thick. And I ended up getting out and I went to Columbia University for graduate school. And although I was doing quite well professionally, I guess by a lot of measures, you know, I was at a really good school and had been this highly ranked officer and was getting job offers at prestigious companies, I was spiraling. You know, I was isolating, I was angry, I was going through a divorce, and I had tried a lot of different traditional approaches like SSRIs and anti-anxiety medications and, you know, you name it. And nothing was working. And I was fortunate enough to meet this guy by the name of Hom Nguyen, who saw how much I was struggling. He kind of saw, he saw through my tough exterior, and he took me under his wing and he taught me meditation. And meditation was my first entry into this different world. And that was about 10 years ago. And shortly thereafter, I had my first, you know, structured approach or session with psilocybin. And that was profound. And, you know, that opened up a lot of things and kind of started me on this journey about 10 years ago. So maybe I'll pause there and then
you. A perfect place right there. And so now that you've sort of discussed how you, your background to this, so the Beckley Retreats, you guys are working with the Beckley Foundation, which is Amanda Fielding, who is a legend in psychedelics, which is amazing that's your sort of co-founder for this. And so you guys are doing sort of these structured retreats in Jamaica, and I believe you're going to be moving to the Netherlands sometime in the near future.
Yeah, we've had some programs in the Netherlands. We'll have some more in the Netherlands. We're primarily focused in Jamaica right now. But yeah, and Amanda's an icon. I mean, she's amazing, and it's really humbling to have her as a co-founder in this work. And, you know, her vision was always to get these compounds and practices to people, you know, to the masses, but like do it safely. And she knew that she needed the data. She knew she needed research to be able to kind of prove to the skeptics that there was something here. And she's done that, you know, and now the public conversations quite different in these last couple of years around these compounds. And so this is the next phase of her vision, which is getting it out to more and more people safely and mindfully. It's really special. And she's 80 years old. She's still working 12-hour days. I mean, she loves this stuff, and she's absolutely brilliant. She's really
And she was a thought partner with Albert Hofmann. I believe she got off of smoking with LSD.
Right.
You know, people describe her as the Countess of Psychedelics, which is it is a very interesting title to have. Like, I can only hope to be the Squire of Psilocybin or some nonsense someday. Right? Like, that's a pretty impressive title to have.
Yeah.
So can you just sort of walk us through, like, how does this work with Beckley Retreats? Like, how do you, is there a screening process? Do people contact you? What does this whole thing look like?
Yeah, well, I can just describe the program a bit. You know, I mean, we really believe in the mystical experience, which you can give people with these compounds. But we believe that not only is it safer, but you can get a lot more out of it if you do it in a structured program, kind of with a more thoughtful, comprehensive approach. So our programs are 11 weeks, and they start with 4 weeks of digital preparation. And luckily, you know, the world is open to consuming material and interacting through digital means now, so it actually works really well. But we get the group dynamic started in those first 4 weeks. You know, everybody gets to meet each other that's coming down on a program. Our programs are usually 15 to 20 participants. We'll have 6 to 7 facilitators, so everybody gets to kind of meet each other. And then we teach these basic well-being practices, which to us, you know, it's the foundation. You got to have a fertile soil for these new insights and these experiences to land in. So we teach people meditation and breath work and mindful movement. We encourage some healthy diet changes. And then we use a Western psychotherapy informed approach to doing the self-reflection exercises and getting the intentions right, because we know mindset matters, right? I mean, you can see this in medicine with the placebo effect or with Dr. Bedside Manner. So getting people's kind of minds in the right spot is really, really important, and getting them ready to come into the program. And then, you know, our programs are 6 days in person, and then we do all those practices together. Again, it's kind of very meditation heavy. And then we're doing mindful movement. You know, we're deep in nature, which matters. You know, I think that there's definitely some benefit getting people out of the metropolitan areas and giving them a bit of a digital detox, and creating some space around these experiences is really important. And then within those 6 days, we have 2 psilocybin sessions, and those are done in a group. You know, everybody gets their own custom dose of psilocybin, and we can talk kind of more about that. And then these facilitating teams that we have, they're amazing. They're very well trained in this work, and they play live music. There's a lot of science emerging around the benefits of sound and how that interacts with psychedelic experiences. So, you know, we try and really bring best in class to these experiences. And then, you know, we can go more into kind of the specific programming on the 6 days if you'd like, but then the other really important part is the 6-week digital follow-up. So everybody goes home, and then we have a structured 6-week integration program, which is an hour call each week where the group comes back together, again, kind of Western psychotherapy informed approach. Because, you know, from a neuroscience perspective, what it looks like is these high doses put the brain into like a more malleable state. It's more neuroplastic. And so you have this window where if you get people to show up and take ownership and do the work, it looks like they can make real change. They can kind of lay in new thought patterns. They can adopt habits more quickly. And so we have a, you know, really thoughtful approach on how to support people to do that. So they don't just have a mystical experience, have a glow for a couple of weeks, and then go right back to their old ways. Like, we can do better.
You know, I think that's actually a reoccurring issue. You know, like at Compass, there's a lot of, you know, organizations doing their studies with psilocybin, and I think a lot of them lack the reintegration. You know, you have this really profound mystical experience. You might become the universe. You might understand all of these interesting trivial nuances about your behaviors and, you know, suppress trauma and so forth. But then if there's nothing afterwards allowing you to reintegrate back into this, and like you said too, with neuroplasticity, it allows you to change. And if there's nothing creating these habitual forms to allow change to stay, then it reduces the efficacy to some extent, which I think is you're seeing some of the research that it's not showing, you know, what psychedelics are used for. They're looking at it from a Western perspective where, you know, taking medication and you're fine, where it's like, no, this is work. Like this is you're trying to change yourself. No.
Exactly. And we try and be really clear about that. People have to kind of be willing to show up and meet halfway, if not more than halfway. These compounds are tools. They're not magic pills. You're not going to just take them and then mindlessly it's going to shift your life, but they can be an incredible complement to people trying to make real change. That's what we see. And, you know, if you take what these compounds will give people, you know, kind of new perspectives, a new sense of awareness. But like it can bring things up that are challenging, you know what I mean? So then if you just put people back into their old environments without any support, it can be really isolating. You know, you have this like super powerful mystical experience and you go right back to your corporate office job on Monday with nobody to kind of work through it with. It can be really challenging. So we can do a lot better, you know, and I think that's what we're focused on is giving people the tools and the support to get a lot out of these experiences and not.
So out of curiosity, then you were talking about custom dosing, because I'm always sort of interested in this because you see these studies coming out and some are like 2.5 grams or, you know, the equivalent of with synthetic psilocybin. And so you guys, I assume, are using natural mushrooms, which yes. have an interesting, you know, entourage effect, according to some people anyways. So what dosing are you guys doing? Because I feel like, you know, in North America, the dosing can only really be associated with research that is done. So if you're doing custom dosing, what are some of the ranges for this? And what is the criteria to establish custom dosing?
Yeah. So on the first session, you know, it's typically between 1 to 3 mm-hmm. grams. You know, dried psilocybin mushrooms. And then on the second session, it can stay the same or people can go up a little bit, you know, 3 to 4, you know, sometimes 5. It does, you know, obviously it matters the strain of mushrooms that's being used. And, you know, it's a function of, it's a conversation with an individual and the senior facilitators that have been doing this stuff for decades, you know, and like you said, there's some research. It's not like there's tons of double blind placebo yeah. with 2 versus 4 grams, you know? So, we do lean on kind of the facilitating team's intuitions and experience. You know, we know that psilocybin is very safe if you screen out people with severe medical indications, which we can talk about a bit more too. But it's really, you know, what's the person's level of anxiety and kind of what's their history of trauma? You know, generally if someone's having, you know, it looks like something significant is going to come up and they have a lot of resistance, you give them a little bit lower dose so they can understand it and they don't feel as scared. And then generally in that second session, after they've learned how to steer a bit and they see that, you know, it's not as scary as they thought, then they can kind of go up a bit more. But you want the individual to kind of like feel ready to kind of have a bigger and deeper experience.
Well, and it's funny about that too, is that it's people's capacity to let go into the experience, right? Like, you know, fear plays such a pivotal and central role in how we operate on a daily basis. And one could argue that, you know, this internalized sense of fear is the reason why the vast majority of psychiatric conditions and the sense of depression and anxiety sort of afflict everyone. So what sort of I'm kind of getting at is that, do you feel that the dose itself, like would you up it to try and allow people to let go? Like it's such an interesting thing. And I just want to add this as well, is that I actually really appreciate that you're using people's decades of experience to sort of figure this out, as opposed to sort of this North American model of we can only give you 2.5 grams. So that's what you're stuck with.
Yeah. And I hope that we can keep gathering data and we can kind of, you know, be, a thought leader in this, if we're bringing high kind of data collection standards and we're looking at outcomes. But yeah, it, you know, a lot of in this industry for a lot of years, people were kind of using body mass as a indicator of dosing, right? Like the bigger, hey, it's a big 6'5" guy, he's going to need a bigger dose. That's been partially debunked, right? Like they really haven't shown a correlation between dose and mystical experience and body mass, you know? So it's, there's definitely some art to it. I can tell you that, people that have a very, active mind, you know, and are working in careers where they're very analytically focused and it's numbers driven and their mind has is very sharp and they lean on their mind, you know, versus their being or their emotions, those individuals a lot of times do need a heavier dose because there's some fight there. There's some resistance to it, you know? So,
well, it's funny that, like, you know, what the first time I did mushrooms, I just went right into it. Zero issues. Whereas my wife, who was very analytical, I don't think she had an experience the first three or four times that we did it. If anything, she got like a headache, which is, yeah, you know, seemingly kind of interesting. Yeah. So one thing I wanted to ask you was that, you know, of the mushrooms itself, you say you guys use different strains. Now, is that different strains within psilocybin cubensi or like Azurins and, you know, like, what are you?
We use cubensis. I mean, there's a few that we really like. Fatback is one of them. You know, Ghost is another one of them. But we're, you know, we do some experimentation with our teams, right? And we've been, you know, doing some testings with our facilitating teams, to see which ones create the right experience. And again, you know, there's not like a deep data set on this, but certainly some mushrooms are more for, you know, that are, they're a bit lighter, right? Or they a bit more, you know, what less you might want to take. Yeah. Ones you might want to take if you were going to go for a hike or do something in a, you know, like something like that, that are more kind of suited for that. And then there's other ones that are more for what this work is, which is kind of doing the introspection and kind of going inside, you know, and they're a little bit stronger and a little bit deeper.
So that brings up another question that I've asked quite a few people this, and no one really seems to either want to respond to it or knows the response, is that, you know, much like cannabis, you know, you have THC, but then yet in indica or sativa, you have an entirely different effect. And then, you know, within that is a mirage of different applications. Yeah. And so do you think that's the same with psilocybin cubensi in the sense of the entourage effect, whether that's beta carbolines or polysaccharides or whatever, actually have, because, you know, to me, I always wondered if this is marketing. That people say Golden Teacher has this effect and, you know, Malbec and all these different sort of, you know, names that they apply to these things are used for different purposes, much like a tool. So this is, you know, if you want to use an analogy of like a hammer, you have a claw hammer, you have a ball peen, all of them fundamentally are used for different purposes. So do you feel that that's the same way with psilocybin mushrooms, specifically in psilocybin cubensis?
Yes, I do think there's different characteristics and there's some from the different kind of chemical makeup of different strains, you can have different experiences. With that said, it's super individual, just like with cannabis, you know, a sativa will affect two different people quite differently depending on their state. You know what I mean? So it's hard to say that, and it's just hard to, you know, compare this person's personal experience to this other person's personal experience and say they're the same. I mean, how do you do that? Right. So I think there is something there though, but, it's really hard to tease out exactly what we just don't know right now, all the things that are impacting the experience. What I do think we can say though, for sure too, is, set and setting matters. Right. So again, you know, you listen to the psychonauts that have been doing this stuff for decades. And, many of them will say, you know, it's the compound is less than 50% of the experience. It's the mindset. It's the group. It's this, who you're doing it with. It's why you're doing it. It's where you're doing it. And all of that really, 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 really matters. You know what I mean? So that is probably the bigger factor determinant, the set and the setting versus this strain versus that strain, you know what I mean? And that's why we try and have a lot of control, and thoughtfulness into that set and setting. Cause that makes a huge difference.
So question for you too. So without necessarily telling the secrets of the organization, what are some of the examples that you have of sort of like the tools for reintegration? Because, you know, I've asked this question before and I've never really gotten concrete answers. So, you know, maybe for people at home who are doing mushrooms and trying to figure things out afterwards, because I know I can say that I've done some pretty large amounts of mushrooms and was left rather empty and anxious trying to rebuild myself afterwards.
Yeah, and just to kind of add to that, like we've talked to a few other organizations that are doing something similar but in a different capacity, and they always talk about the benefit of having somebody who's got either like a psychotherapy type background, whether it's therapist or shaman or whatever, but they never really explain, like they say it's helpful to have them and we like to have them and it's part of this, but they never really go into what it is they're doing as part of that experience. So I think it would be really valuable for our listeners if you could maybe go into a little bit of detail as to how it is that you guys use these people as part of your ceremonies and what the value it is that they bring to these experiences that you're facilitating.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you take psychotherapy. I mean, there's established, you know, different frameworks to kind of look at different aspects of your life and your way of being and showing up in those relationships. You know, everything's relational and making sense of them, right? So it's really just having a framework to help people make sense of it, in terms of like the psychotherapy approach. With that said, you know, again, you got to have fertile soil, you know, and so that's where we really try and focus, is you got to take care of yourself, right? So the meditation, you know, sometimes I think meditation gets thrown into this bucket of like another well-being practice. I think for us, it's like, no, that it's foundational. You know, like, so you got to figure out a way to have that practice and have that be part of your day. Right. And I think that, you know, if you look at a lot of the, you know, indigenous wisdom out there and you look at psychedelic usage, meditation is part of it, you know, like they're complementary, you know? So if you're just having a mystical experience and then you're going right back into your daily work and you go right back into this frantic way of being, you're going to lose a lot of that essence. You're going to lose a lot of that shift. So you got to get people to develop a meditation practice. You also need to get people to make some lifestyle changes, you know, and like being in nature is really important, right? The science around that is emerging too, but it has a meaningful impact on our central nervous system. We are nature. We need to have interactions with nature. We need to be in nature. So you got to change your habits and figure out a way to get into nature more and be connected. You got to, if you're spending time with, if your entire friend group and community group is people that are chasing the dollar and climbing the corporate ladder and just worrying about prestige, it's going to be hard to make change and live a more kind of connected existence. So you got to find a different network of people that are living differently and thinking differently, you know? So it's a more integrative, holistic well-being approach using psychedelics as a tool.
You know, and I really agree with that whole concept. You know, I find that I know people who have done mushrooms and they eat Big Macs and they don't take care of themselves. They're constantly stressed out and they have this experience, and the experience itself might be amazing, but yet afterwards they just sort of crumble and they're almost worse off than they were before because they don't have any of the practices that allow us to integrate this. And, you know, I completely agree with that when you say that we're nature, and I'm like, yeah, we're animals. You know, we extended from nature. We've just somehow moved ourselves to these weird concrete jungles and capitalistic elitism and stuff like that. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you, and I remember one of our previous conversations, you were saying that you got into the corporate world and then psilocybin and everything else allowed you to sort of move from it. Considering that our modern world is fundamentally based on capitalism and the strive for profit, you know, as we're going into this psychedelic revolution and more people are using them, it kind of, interestingly enough, puts us at odds with the entire society that we've created. I'm actually really curious to see how this works because, you know, the story that I used to be in finance, I did a bunch of mushrooms and then I moved into the bush, or I've, you know, become a farmer, or I'm working with people trying to help people, is a very reoccurring theme that is happening. You know, how do you think this works as we move into the future with this?
Yeah, I think that, you know, these compounds, if used in the right way, can give users this like zoomed out look at themselves and the world, and get people to really kind of embody the knowledge, which is happiness does not derive from material things. That's a bit of a myth. And we've studied this. We see this. You can show this. Once, you know, happiness is correlated up until your basic needs are met plus some, right? Like you need some money for adventure and for, you know, for exploration and things like this. But then after that, at best, it's not correlated. At worst, it's negatively correlated. So this whole obsession with like maximizing your individual wealth as a means to happiness is not really accurate. And I do think that psilocybin gives people, you know, a deeper understanding of that truth outside of just a rational thought exercise. If they're like, I get it. And you're able to kind of like let some of those things go past you without grasping onto them. You're able to think more independently. And although there's so much momentum around all of us, and so many external things pushing us in that direction, it allows you to think for yourself and to kind of look inside and be like, what do I need to kind of have a happy and content life? You know, it helps break out of these kind of autopilot modes that we just get accustomed to being in after living in this, you know, Western world.
Well, and yeah, like I personally think that we've all been brainwashed since we're children. You know, like advertising itself is based on psychology, and it's entirely designed to make you feel insecure so that I can buy a product that somehow satiates that.
Exactly. And corporations are getting bigger with more resources. I mean, and they hire the smartest PhDs in the world to design that marketing, you know, to do that, right? And you know, because we've moved away from a more kind of nature-centered, community-based way of living, which we kind of need at our core to feel content and whole, we're all operating in a bit of a state of fight or flight, right? All of our central nervous systems are a bit activated just by virtue of living in this world. And that's a, you know, for marketers or for companies trying to sell stuff, you know, you want people that don't feel whole, right? You want people that are looking for external things to fill them up, you know what I mean? Or things that they can sell you to fill them up. So it's like, it's this vicious cycle, right? And then, you know, the material stuff, I mean, it's just like eating a sugar diet, you know what I mean? There's no nutritional value in it. It'll give you a bit of a bump. It'll give you a dopamine hit. You'll feel good for a bit, but then it actually ends up leaving you more empty. So then you got to eat more to fill it up. I mean, I grew up, you know, relatively like lower middle class. And then when I was at Columbia University, kind of for the first time in my life, was around extreme wealth, like hundreds of millions of dollars, family wealth, billion to dollar kids there. And I can tell you, it never ends. You know what I mean? The billionaire families would tell stories about their fathers or, you know, their, and it was never enough because they, in their circle and who they had compared themselves to, someone had more billions, you know? So it's an addiction. It's a madness, you know what I mean? And, you know, we've got to figure out how to help people kind of have experiences and give people new ways of looking at the world so that they can, yeah, look inside and try and figure out what I really need to kind of feel whole. And it's not what all the world is telling me. We've lost our way a bit.
Well, it almost seems like we need to reevaluate our sense of self-worth. You know what I mean? Like if we're constantly convinced that material possessions somehow validates who we are as an individual, then we're constantly going to be seeking that. You know, like I've said before that I think that psychedelics are an antidote for the 21st century. And I think we need them now more than ever. And so
I think so too. But I, you know, used unwisely, used in the wrong way, they can exacerbate issues. You know what I mean? I think that I always without bringing like politics into it, I think everybody's pretty clear that, you know, the guy with the horns during the January 6th insurrection, remember, you hit yep. with the face paint, you know, he was a psychedelic shaman. Psychedelic shaman. So, you know, it just giving people psychedelics on its own without, you know, some connection and without some support, it isn't, you know, it doesn't, giving people psychedelics doesn't make them a good connected person, you know, and I mean it. So they're a tool, and any tool can be used well or not well or good or bad. And so I think that, you know, in this world, you know, there are people that I've heard this. It's like, let's just get it in the water supply. You know what I mean? Like, let's just figure out a way to just like get it to the masses. And I'm like, no, I don't agree with that. You know what I mean? That's not going to necessarily help us. It's actually going to, you know, psychedelics have a way of kind of accentuating what's there. So if there's a lot of, you know, deep anxiety and franticness, you know, psychedelics can actually kind of make that worse if you're not helping people develop that fertile ground and that base of well-being alongside that. You know what I mean?
Well, I think putting it in the water supply is a bad idea. The CIA tried that a couple times already. It didn't work out very well.
Well, and I have heard that frequently, you know, just dose everyone. But I completely agree with you. Like, psychedelics to me is a tool, and like a bread knife. You can cut bread or you can cut someone's head off. Like, it really comes down to the individual using it. And, you know, like you said, it can accentuate, you know, negative aspects of our personality. I completely agree with that. And so one of the things that I kind of want to, you know, seems like a good segue, is that what is your quote unquote success rate in the methodology that you're currently using? You know, so do you have people coming in? Like, are you geared toward veterans, being that you're a veteran? Are you geared towards just people with life struggles, or are you sort of tackling people with depression and with anxiety? And, you know, I know that's sort of a multifaceted question, but
I can try and take it like one piece of time. So our programs aren't specifically for veterans. Obviously, I have a, you know, I'm connected to veterans. I know this work can help veterans. We're doing a program in the spring with Heroic Hearts where we're fully funding and bringing down a group of 15 veterans. So I'm really excited about that. Our programs are more designed, you know, our programs are not clinical. They're not medical, you know, specifically, you know, we're not allowed to treat or diagnose or treat PTSD, severe depression. You know, if people come into the system, you know, we do a really robust screening and we turn a lot of people away, right? Because our programs are specifically designed more for the betterment of the well, is what we would say. Now, do people have issues that they're working through when they come down? Well, yeah, of course, because we're humans, you know, but like, our programs are more for, you know, people wanting to go from good to great, to thriving, to being more empathetic. And some common themes we hear from people coming down, one is like, people will say like, I'm stuck. Like, I'm just stuck. Like I've been wanting to make all these changes and I just can't make any changes. And I'm just like looking for something that'll help me kind of make a real shift. And I do think these programs are great for that. I mean, this can be like a huge, like, boom, and then you know, pivot for people if they do the work, right? Like if they show up and do the work. We also have a lot of people that'll come down and will have like a recent loss or in their life, you know, like a death of a loved one or you know, they just lost their job and they want to kind of come to terms with that and like give it, honor it, but like, you know, they don't want it holding them back anymore. They're like, I want to move forward. I want to move past this. What, you know, I want to get into the rest of my life, you know, in a mindful way. And I think, again, these programs are like really well suited for that. And then we have quite a few people that come down and they're like, I'm great. Like, my life's great. My family's great. I want to explore. I want to get closer to connection. I want to become more empathetic. I want to like unlock more creativity. And so there's a big bucket of people that do that. And those are, you know, people that can get a lot out of the program as well.
Well, and one thing that I've found that's rather interesting is that, you know, everyone's like, I'm fine. You know, and I'm always, and people are like, oh, I'm good. I don't have any problems. And I'm like, it's because you haven't looked. You haven't, you know, and there's something interesting about humans is that, you know, we acclimatize to anything. You give us any period of time, whether it's good or bad, we will normalize to that circumstance. And life has this insidious way of piling traumas on top of one another in this slow, meticulous fashion that you just get used to carrying that backpack full of weight.
Absolutely.
And for me, like, I always thought I was fine until I did Ibogaine, and it was like, oh, I am not fine.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like you said too, it's for me, it was almost like just completely leveling this weird dystopian city, like just, you know, saturation bombing it and then rebuilding again. Like, you know, my entire life I had been building this toxic structure and then having this capacity to completely rebuild in a way that was, you know, more healthy, I think is one way of saying that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Like, again, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I just want to piggyback for a second, because you're talking about the intake process and like some of the people who are seeking out your services. And it really sounds like you care about the success of these individuals as they kind of go through this metamorphosis with you. What I'm wondering is, you talked a lot about the habits that are required for the success. And as far as I know, like habit formation successfully typically takes about 30 days on average. I think that's what the science kind of supports. So with that in mind, do you guys create some of these lifestyle changes like the meditation, the working out, the better eating and all that as a prerequisite as part of coming into the ceremonies so that you're ensuring that these people are set up for the best successes? Or is this kind of like homework after the fact for the participants? And do you guys kind of set up that framework for them?
Mm-hmm. No, so we're encouraging people, you know, through the preparation program to try and start developing some of these habits, right? And, you know, so we give people instruction on meditation and breath work, and we try and give people some of the research around why some of these new habits might help be helpful for them, right? So that they have some buy-in and they want to do it. So, we start that at the beginning of the program. I mean, people come in at all different levels. So it's more about just trying to give people, you know, the tools so that they can kind of keep working up their own improvement curve. And then, yeah, I mean, afterwards, for sure, we continue that. We continue encouraging the development of these habits. And, you know, you got this window after the high dose psilocybin experience where it looks like if you try and make the change, you might be more likely to get it to stick because the brain's in this is a different state. And, you know, doing this stuff in groups matters too. You know, I was, when we first started doing some of these group integration sessions, a lot of our guests that come down are what I would call like type A overachievers, you know, professionals that have like really busy careers. And I was like, there's no way we're going to get these individuals to show up for these weekly calls because they've got stuff to do. And I've been pleasantly surprised at how much people show up. Because I think we're setting the expectations that that's how they get the most out of it. So they know they need to do it and they don't want to leave something on the table. They see this as an investment and they're like, I'm going to get out of it what I can. And people show up for the group. You know what I mean? And I think we try and encourage that tribe dynamic of where people show up for each other. It's an individual experience, but you get to meet these people. You go through something pretty profound together. And you want to support the other people on making change. So, you know, there's something really, really important about doing this work in groups. And if you look at, again, different cultures throughout the world that have done it for a long time, they do it in groups, they do it in communities, you know, they do it together. It's not just the one-on-one with the clinician in a office building somewhere.
Well, and that's actually, we interviewed Dr. Jared Rose, who's a sociologist, who did his PhD in group psilocybin sort of ceremonies. And he actually gets into the idea that being in the group and that dynamic that's established actually significantly increases the probability of people having these more positive results, as opposed to, you know, being in a room with a potted plants with a psychotherapist and, you know, some headphones on, you know. And I think that's part of the thing, is that we have two different perspectives. One is this Western perspective, where it's very sanitized, maybe is the word I'm looking for. And then this other version where it seems more correlated to indigenous communities who have been using this for thousands of years. And I feel like you guys are sort of blending two of these things together, which I kind of very much appreciate.
Yeah. And we're trying, I think there's something beautiful in the blend. We think there's value in the Western approach. And you know, bringing some rigor to it, particularly, I mean, for sure around like safety standards and protocols and, you know, the West has a lot to offer in terms of like how to standardize things, right? So that we ensure that we're safe. But yeah, I guess, you know, Western science is a bit limited in that you have to isolate a single variable, you know what I mean? And what we're doing here is multivariable, right? So it's like nature matters, the compound matters, the group dynamic matters, the live music matters, the preparate, you know what I mean? And so what we're doing is, you know, taking lessons from kind of both traditions or both philosophies and then tracking outcome, you know what I mean? And as long as we're getting positive outcome, you know, and even if we can't isolate it to like the specific, for the specific music, we know that this comprehensive program is working and we're going to just keep doing that so long as we're getting good outcomes, you know?
So question for you. So, you know, I would imagine that psilocybin is what you're using because it's currently legal in Jamaica, which is obviously beneficial. So Amanda stems from LSD.
Yeah.
So do you guys, as legislation most likely will change, do you guys plan on sort of expanding the tryptamine repertoire to different compounds or combinations, or, you know, one night LSD, one night psilocybin, or any variation?
Yeah, I hope that Beckley can become kind of the trusted, safe place for exploration with lots of different compounds. You know what I mean? I think if people want to do them, then they should do them safely. And if we can give them the place to do them safely and legally, then I think, we, you know, but crawl, walk, run. Psilocybin actually works really well. You know, it's got, out of all of the psychedelics, you know, arguably the most research, right? So we feel comfortable in its usage. And you know, why not ayahuasca, or why not you know, 5-MeO? Well, there's a lot of cultural sensitivities around some of those plants too. Yeah. You know, and so before we ever made a decision to do something like that, we would have to be like 100% sure that we're like honoring those traditions, and that, you know, the cultures that have held those practices and compounds approve of what we're doing. You know, we're not going to just come in and just like, you know what I mean? We're not going to bring in this just like Western approach and
colonialists come in, take something and create some sort of stereotypical version of it and then provide it. Yeah. No, I
guess. Yeah, exactly. But if we can create, you know, we're already doing this. If we can create relationships with those communities and they believe that we have something of value to bring to the table and they want to work, we can like find good ways to partner. And then we would do that, but we're not going to just, you know, mindlessly take some compound from some tradition and make it ours. You know, we want to be more mindful. There's like this work requires a different approach. There's a lot of things to consider when you're making a decision of you're going to use one of these kind of like different compounds that has a lot of history and cultural ties, you know what I mean? And I think that it's a bit troubling to see some organizations seeing dollar signs and moving a bit quickly, too quickly, in to try and just make dollars, without considering all the different stakeholders that are out there and trying to do this the right way. I think that we got to do better than that.
Well, it is vaguely ironic that our current system revolves around capitalism. And if you want money being dumped into something, that you have to play and abide by those rules. But yet what is invariably being promoted sort of goes against the entire system of capitalism, which is promoting it. And it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out. And that kind of takes me to one other question. So when we were talking earlier, you kind of took your history sort of right to a point, and then we started talking about Beckley retreats. So out of curiosity, you know, I think it's safe to say that you did psilocybin. Can you just tell me, like, how did that experience affect you? And, you know, you went from working in sort of finance and math and so forth, and now here you are, you know what I mean? So second part
that 10 years, I can kind of tell you that quickly. So I was in grad school. I was really struggling. I found meditation and psychedelics, and I kind of went on this multi-year journey of where I got really deep on meditation. I had this almost from day one. I was like, oh man, there's something here. It was hard. Like it was really challenging, but I just knew, I was like, this is it. And I was lucky that I had a bit of the soldier's discipline. So I was able to kind of like force myself to sit, even though it was like maddening. And then I was also experimenting with different psychedelics over those years, you know, on the underground in the US, and then also in different parts of Central America, mostly Mexico. And I was doing better over this period of time. I was taking better care of myself. The alcoholism went away. The anxiety started to go away. You know, it didn't happen overnight, but over the course of a few years, I got to a point where I was doing pretty well. And I graduated from Columbia, and then I went and did a teacher certification in meditation at Jefferson University in MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction, which I love and still teach, and I think it's a really accessible form of meditation for people that are getting started. And then I was teaching meditation. I actually kind of went back into the military communities and the intelligence communities and was teaching meditation there. And then was working on a small business with my brother in my hometown. And I was doing all of these things. Like, I had the fertile soil. So I had meaningful, purposeful work. I was in nature a lot. I was exercising and taking care of myself. I had a very strong meditation practice, like every day without fail. And magically, when you do those things and you get your mind and body in alignment, like, life flows better. It requires less effort. Things kind of sync up. You know, there is really some magic to it that's hard to kind of really appreciate until you've experienced this different way of interacting with the world. And then, so I was doing that for a bit of time after grad school. And then I had been deferring this job offer with McKinsey and Company. And I asked McKinsey and Company for another deferral. Basically, can I punt one more year? I'm having fun doing what I'm doing. And they were like, no, we're not going to be your permanent backup plan. We love you, Neil, but like, are you kidding me? We're McKinsey was essentially the sentiment. And I was like, okay. So I went back to my brother and I was like, you know, I always wanted to see what was behind the curtain. You know, like, the business world puts this organization on a pedestal and I'm curious. And so I ended up going, and my McKinsey experience was really interesting. I mean, part of me loved it. It's super intellectually stimulating. Again, I'm like a lower middle class kid from Frederick, Maryland. So then all of a sudden I'm like in boardrooms and like flying first class. And so it was like, you know, it was kind of cool. And I got to co-lead the internal mindfulness program with a really good friend of mine that has become a really good friend of mine since then. And so that there was a lot of goods. Now looking back with the benefit of hindsight, my mental health started going the other way, though, because look, it's not my work, you know? And the stress of the environment is kind of crazy. It's a bit frantic. It's all about the money at the end of the day, you know? And I think there's amazing people there, but like, I just don't think it's a noble cause to make Fortune 200 companies bigger or more efficient. I mean, I got lost in it. So I'm not trying to be contemptuous, but like, now it's like, no, that's just not where I want to spend my time and it's interesting, you know, like, if you're doing work that's not in alignment with you, even if you're not thinking about it every day, if you're not like, oh, this isn't for me, your body knows, you know, your body is aware that you're kind of living out of sync, and it's going to try and tell you. But we're stubborn, and a lot of times we don't listen, and we'll try and shut it up with alcohol or distracting ourselves or working harder, right? So you get in this habit. And then, you know, I was at McKinsey for a few years and, you know, I did well there, but I was kind of losing my way. And then I got recruited to go to this boutique consultancy that was doing private equity portfolio company restructuring. So that is companies that are like $100 million to $500 million, mostly distributed services businesses. And we were like the drop-in interim CEOs or chief transformation officers as these companies were going through bankruptcy or, you know, near or around bankruptcy times. So it was even more toxic and more capitalist. And it affected me, you know. I mean, I have like these memories of being in New York City for these boardrooms where we would just whip out laptops and we'd look at the headcount and we'd just like talk about people like machines. And it's dehumanizing and it's all about money. And it sucked the life out of me. At this point, you know, I completely lost my meditation practice. You know, I was isolating again. My relationships were struggling, and but still like doing well, like by a lot of measures, you know. And then in my last role, I kind of co-led a restructuring for this $500 million business, and the CEO liked me, and he asked me to come on as an executive for this business after doing the restructuring, and I did. And the environment was super toxic, and you know, but I was the youngest executive by 16 years, and I had, you know, so by most measures, it was like Neil is killing it professionally, but I was miserable. I was absolutely miserable. I was anxious. I wasn't sleeping. And so a few years ago, I got to basically another breaking point. I wasn't as bad as I was coming out of the service, but it was close. And I'm looking around at my peers, and these are all people that, you know, are quite entitled and have good educations. And a lot of them are super unhappy and exhibiting what I would call PTSD symptoms, but not from combat, but from shitty work environments chasing money. Yeah. And so I kind of just got to a point where I was like, I'm done. And I left, and I didn't know what I was going to do, but I knew that I had been well before. Right. And it's like, I was just like, let's get back to basics. I got back into meditation, and then this whole thing with Beckley has kind of come out of that quite organically, which again, I think is a signal that there's some alignment with the work, you know what I mean? And so yeah, that's my story too, and that's why it's so important to me to know that we got to help people maintain these habits, give them new community, because if you go back into those old environments, you know, old habits die hard, and it's really easy to slip. Really easy to slip back into these old ways.
Well, and I don't want to say life is an uphill battle, but in a way it kind of is, right? You're constantly in this innate struggle with the society around you and trying to maintain some degree of being centered with yourself. And it takes a lifetime of effort. You know, I think that everyone's looking for a magic pill. And I get that. I want a magic pill too, but that they just don't exist. You know what I mean? Like it's a slow meandering pathway. Like I've been doing psychedelics for 10 years and we had discussed this too, like very similar histories, 10 years. And you know what I mean? Like paramedic is not the same as, you know, combat, but it still has its own traumatizing effects in itself. And yeah, man, it seems to be this, it's a lifetime effort that you have to put into. And I think people need to understand that. I think they need to realize that it's more than just taking a pill, having a, you know, this mind bending spiritual experience, and then all of a sudden being cured for the rest of your life.
It's a commitment to daily effort. You know what I mean? And we always have free will, so we can always fall off that path if we don't, you know, stay disciplined and have people around us that are going to support us in the right ways, you know? But there's real value here. I mean, like no question is there something special and unique here in these compounds. You know, they can really, really help people.
Well, and I would say too, like, you know, it's the one thing that I'm very curious to see is how Western culture and Western medicine sort of blends in with the mysticism of psychedelics, because psychedelics leaves you with experiences that are so deeply unexplainable. You know what I mean? These ideas of you know, I'm going to use the term God for lack of a better term, infinite complexity, whatever. And you have these experiences of oneness with the universe, which cannot be explained in any way, shape, or form with science. And here we are trying to force these two things together. And sometimes I wonder, is it the same shape that's going to fit through that hole? Or are we trying to mash a triangle through a circle here? Like, it's, how does this work going forward? Is this something that we can blend? Or is this something that's going to constantly be at odds with one another as we move forward?
Yeah, there's no question tension. I mean, I think it's fascinating. I come from I love math and physics. And if you look at physics and you dig deep enough, there are things that we have no idea how they work. Right. And at the scale that these things happen, it's like, it's so far beyond our ability to be able to rationalize. You have to be humbled by it. Yeah. You know, and if you look at a lot of the physicists over the last couple hundred years that like got up to this edge and saw kind of what happens below it all, they knew that there was something that wasn't mechanistic and wasn't like, it's quite different than what we see in this material world that we operate in. Huge. It's way, 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 way bigger than us. So, I'm convinced we will never be able to fully explain it. I think that by definition, it's the inexplainable, right? And so, it's going to take some humility for us as coming from the West that needs to be able to draw a straight line between everything to say that it's real, right? To humble ourselves to be like, there is things that are beyond beyond our ability to fully rationalize, you know.
Well, and technically, according to quantum physics, we all exist. Reality exists as a wave function of potential that only becomes something when observed. You know what I mean? Yeah, and people get that in a quantum level, but we are quantum. Like, I am composed of cells, which are composed of molecules, which are composed of subatomic particles. And you go down to these, you know, very small quantum subplanet lengths. And yeah, it's wildly insane that we all just exist.
It's insane. I know. And like, yeah, you and me and everything is, you know, 99.999% space. It's way more nothingness than something. And I love one of the analogies, the metaphors, you know, if you took the earth and you collapsed it actually down to actual matter, you know, you took out all the space between the proton, neutron, and the electron that's bouncing around, and you collapse it down to be the size of a basketball, you know? And so, I mean, how the hell does that make sense? Like, so it's just like, you know, we don't understand. There's just things that are happening that we can see that like we don't have good answers for. And I think that if anything, I hope that like humbles people to be open to the fact that there's stuff that is real that we might not be able to get our minds fully around. You know what I mean? And for me, you know, that was a challenge because I thought that I knew everything or could figure everything out. And anything I couldn't figure out, I kind of disregarded. And it's like, well, we might not ever figure this out, but it doesn't mean it's not real, you know?
No, that's a fair statement. And so, hey, man, we're coming to an end of the interview, but so how do people get in touch with Beckley Retreats? You know, do you want to talk about anything that you guys are doing in the near future? Any type of plugs that you want to let?
Yeah, we've got programs up on the website in the spring. So, you know, check them out. You can book a call with someone on our team or join an info session. And, you know, I mean, we're a small boutique company, so we're very accessible. And if people want to reach out to me, I love talking about this stuff. It's probably, hopefully that's obvious through this interview. It's like fascinating to me and I really believe in it. And, Neil, yeah, I mean, go to, yep.
No, I was going to say, I know it strays a little bit from psychedelics, but can you talk a little bit more about the type of meditation that you're kind of supportive of? Because I'm curious about that. I don't think I've ever heard of that style before.
Yeah,
Can you talk a little more about it? Sure.
Mindfulness-based stress reduction was developed by Dr. Jon Kabat-Zinn at the University of Massachusetts. And he studied in the East under Buddhist practitioners, you know, in the 70s, I think. Yeah, 70s. And was like, oh wow, this is huge. This is beyond mind, right? You know, and it was transformational experience for him. And he was like, I want to bring this back to the West, but there's just no way I'm going to get any traction if I bring it back with the spiritual ties, because, you know, there's the Christian lens here, and Buddhism was not widely accepted. And so what he did, which I think is brilliant, was he actually just like looked at what the practices were, you know, and it's this present moment awareness, right? As there's a difference between kind of being lost in thought, or he would say lost in the thought stream, and being aware of the present moment. And so you can do all of these exercises without any Buddhist or spiritual kind of lens and get a lot of the benefit. And so I loved it because it was accessible to me. 10 years ago, I didn't want a spiritual tradition. I just wanted to feel better. So I could do MBSR without feeling like I needed to believe in something. Now, through MBSR, my mind has been opened up, and I would say I'm quite spiritual now, in that I have practices and rituals that I do because I believe there's value in them. And I like have a gratitude practice. Can I explain definitively how me thinking about something positive goes into the ether and produces something back better? No. But can I see it happening in my life? Do I believe it through experience? Yeah. And there's a reason why a lot of spiritual traditions have these rituals, because they figured them out through experience that they work, you know what I mean? And so I still, though, teach and really love MBSR, just because it's accessible, and you don't, regardless of what your existing religious or spiritual beliefs are, you can still just do this work, and I think get a lot of like benefit out of it. It's just practicing the present moment awareness of its simplest form.
Now, Neil, is this something that you teach online, or is it something that you do classes in person specifically? And where would somebody looking to seek this out, what direction could you point them?
You just Google MBSR, mindfulness-based stress reduction. The core program's 8 weeks long, and that's like the good place to get started. You can do them all over the place. You can do them digitally. I would recommend doing an in-person one, because again, there's something special about being together and in a group. And I mean, I love teaching this stuff. I just don't have a lot of time to teach it right now. So no. I'm trying to figure out a way where I can just get to a place where all I'm doing is teaching meditation and talking about psychedelics. But right now
yeah. You're still a busy guy. Yeah.
Well, time is such a valuable commodity. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's incredible how that works.
Okay, yeah. So once again, for our listeners, you said it's the Berkeley Institute?
No, Beckley Retreats.
The Beckley Retreats.
Beckley Retreats, yeah. And you'll learn some MBSR. You'll learn some meditation techniques for sure in one of our
programs. And is there a website or a Twitter or an Instagram you can point people towards for that?
Yep, at Beckley Retreats for Instagram. You know, Beckley Retreats on LinkedIn. And then it's just beckleyretreats.com for our website. And if you go to the website, you can see all the retreat dates. The spring is filling up, you know, it's actually quite a few of them are already full. And yeah, reach out. I mean, join one of our sessions or reach out to me, and I'd be happy to kind of whatever you need, answer more questions or spitball about quantum physics, whatever.
Yeah, no, man, honestly, like every conversation I've had with you has been awesome. And, you know,
I feel the same way, brother.
Right. Yeah. And I wish you guys extreme amounts of success with this, because I think the world needs it more than ever. And I really appreciate what you guys are doing. And I think you're doing it the right way. And
I appreciate that.
Yeah, man. You have yourself a wonderful day, and we'll talk again soon, man. Take care.
Thank you, buddy. See ya.
See you, man.